This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Laura Stark, Associate Professor at Vanderbilt University. I had the chance to talk with the writer and historian Alicia Puglionisi, whose book, In Whose Ruins, Power, Possession, and the Landscapes of American Empire, came out with the trade press Scribner in April 2022. The book is decidedly anti-capitalist and resoundingly anti-colonial. It's organized into four sections, or sites, that visit four evocative landscapes: a native burial mound in present-day West Virginia, native oil wells at the tip of the Appalachian Mountains, petroglyphs along the Susquehanna River, and the Sonoran Desert, rich with pottery, uranium, and physicists, both white and native. At each of these sites, people with different political projects had generated multiple accounts of the landscapes and ideas evaluation. So within a context of shifting political power, white settler origin stories about each of these sites displaced empirical knowledge of native labor, skill, presence, and endurance with harmful fables of white origins and of native communities' need for white so-called rescue. Into the present day, the effect has been to justify white theft of native land and deadly violence against tribal communities for the purposes of resource extraction. And in the end, even the false white origin stories became a resource to commodify. Puglionisi is a writer I really admire. She writes poetry, fiction, academic scholarship, including her 2020 book, Common Phantoms, and now In Whose Ruins, a mass market trade publication. She holds a PhD in history of medicine and a lecturer in medicine, science, and humanities at the Johns Hopkins University. On the page, Puglionisi also has a really friendly, funny, quiet presence. She's sort of like a Where's Waldo that centers the relationships of the historical actors, including spirits, and also her own text-based relationships with other scholars, including important Native scholars Kim Tallbear, Zoe Todd, Eve Tuck, and many others. So this conversation explores ways of living in good relation via writing, the status of truth, especially for historians, and the relevance of singer-songwriter Prince for everybody, but especially labor studies, and many other themes. We also discussed the important book by Chadwick Allen, Earthworks Rising, out in 2022 from Minnesota. And in an unrecorded snippet, we also swapped the names of our favorite local independent bookstores. And you can check out those stores and their names and links to them in the notes. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Hello, this is Laura Stark, and I am talking with Alicia Puglionisi, and it is April of 2022, and we're talking about In Whose Ruins, which actually just came out a few weeks ago. So it's hot off the press with a major trade press as well. So Alicia, there's so many things I admire about this book and also about you as a writer. And so I wanted to start off by asking you about your many genres you write in. So there's poetry, you have a novella, and your very recently published scholarly nonfiction book, Common Phantoms, as well as this mass market book that's a really fantastic, In Whose Ruins, that also came out. So I was just wondering, do you use these different genres as palate cleansers? So you're kind of moving from one to another, or are you always writing complementarily in different genres?
Yeah, that's a great question. And also thank you, Laura, for talking with me today. Yeah, I don't tend to think a lot about process, but it is the case that like I'm usually doing those things in parallel, but with a project like that, you know, with like a book project, like ultimately when it comes down to it, you're like spending like 14-hour days like with your eyes glued to a computer, just like editing and revising. And so after everything was finished with this book, I did want to, like, I have gotten back to doing poetry, and actually I really want to write a novel. That's my next thing. But they're all kind of related, and it's all kind of connected material. And like, also like my sources for nonfiction history writing are also often literature. I read a lot of 19th century novels and early 20th century. And so I think fiction and poetry are always in the mix for me, whether it's something that I'm practicing or as like sources for understanding.
That's so interesting to hear. And as we go along, if there are any inspirations from poetry or fiction or anything like that, that come to mind that you want to tell me your listeners about, I'd actually really love to hear them. And I wanted also to ask about the link between Common Phantoms, the book that you published. It was in 2020 it came out. Is that right, Alicia?
Yeah, a bunch of pandemic books.
Yeah, that was right on the start of the pandemic. And then you have this one out 2 years later, which is it's a big book, and it reads quickly. And I should also say, it's actually quite funny. You have a wonderful sense of humor without writing yourself into the story very directly. So I appreciated that as well. About you have a serious politics in the book as well, a very anti-capitalist, anti-colonial politics in this book on landscape. And so I take the book overall to be basically a history of histories. So it's about the ways in which people create stories specifically about landscapes and these distinctive landscape formations that people have tried to explain and understand that are in their midst in various ways, and particularly looking at the late 19th century and early 20th century United States. So within sort of that landscape, there is, well, I was going to say inevitably, but it, of course, for myself speaking as a white settler scholar, I don't take it for granted that it would seem relevant and obvious that the history of native dispossession, it should be central to that story. And it absolutely is central to your book, In Whose Ruins. So in thinking about this transition from Common Phantoms that came out in 2020 and this book, In Whose Ruins, in 2022, it seems like there is, in both of them, stories of absent presences. So Common Phantoms is about the psychical sciences in the 19th century. And this book is about sort of the histories that are told and not told in material spaces. So I was wondering if you could talk about the connection, or if it's totally fabricated between the two books.
No, it's very literal. Like there was a section, or I wrote a chapter for Common Phantoms that was expanding on mediumistic encounters with indigenous earthworks. and looking at the history of Henry Rowe Schoolcraft as sort of a white medium for the Ojibwe stories and traditions of his wife, Jane Johnson Schoolcraft, and her relatives. And so I wrote that chapter and it didn't really fit with Common Phantoms, which is, yeah, like a history of a prehistory of parapsychology kind of, and the mind sciences. But, you know, in that, in Common Phantoms, it's very much concerned with mediumship and channeling and like, in some ways, like the authentication of communication, like how do we know who's really speaking, who's being spoken through, and who is like speaking for others out of turn. And like, of course, how do we understand like the permission of the dead? Like how do the dead assent or not to being kind of mobilized in different ways? And so I took that chapter out of Common Phantoms and was kind of thinking through it. It just seemed like sort of a slightly different set of questions that was about human relationality, but also about relations to land and the memory that is sort of in land. And so, yeah, and also, you know, looking at this history of North American earthworks, you know, as like sort of a very explicit example of sort of manifest destiny colonialism, like the reinterpretation of earthworks as white, as having somehow a European origin, contrary to all evidence. That move sort of turned me to thinking about resources, land as a resource, and other kinds of resources, and our sort of spiritual narratives around them, around the discovery of hidden secrets, like the retelling of the past in ways that are sort of suited to particular political ends. And so that was kind of how I departed on this trajectory.
Yeah, I can definitely, it is a quite literal connection, because it sounds like the first section of In Whose Ruins, which is about mounds and earthworks in Maryland, the U.S. state of Maryland now, and the ways that they've been narrated and the origins looked for, that actually was originally a piece of Common Phantoms. So I can see that it is literally taking out of one and putting into another. So the book In Whose Ruins then is organized around four sites. And so I just want to start off by asking you about the structure of the book and the intentional decision that you made to call the sections sites, and to think through the language and the idioms of landscape, because each of the sections takes up a kind of earth formation. So the first one is about the mounds. The second one is about oil wells in Western Pennsylvania. The third one is about the rock drawings that were turned up in a damming of a river between Pennsylvania and Maryland, which was its own dispute. And then turning to the landscape of the Southwest and the different resources under capitalism that were turned up in the Los Alamos area. So in thinking about these as sites, I could imagine another author might think of them as episodes, or might think about them as object histories, because they are each oriented around a particular type of thing in these spaces. So could you talk about what you're getting at and what you're really trying to emphasize implicitly in this organization of the book into these four sections?
I think that in considering them as sites, I was interested in not just the episode that is sort of most often demarcated as significant. These sort of like, again, very mythologized episodes of like the Manhattan Project at Los Alamos or the discovery of oil in Western Pennsylvania and the oil boom. But like considering the deep history of the places where these things happened and how that history was also a resource in the narratives that would then be constructed around oil or around, you know, nuclear power. And so considering like the site and like trying to understand the forces that were at play there before the event that locked that place into like the progress of capitalism kind of was, yeah, I think just part of providing a fuller history of those events. And they're sort of very like canonical events. And so it's like, even talking about the history of the Manhattan Project is like, I'm not qualified to do that. You know, I'm not a historian of Cold War physics. But like, there's so much there in terms of what the people in that place were drawing upon to tell their story and to feel at home and to identify as people of that place, that I think that's where the idea of a site becomes apparent, that like they seem to be really engaging in very place-based thinking and narrative about themselves.
Yeah, that language that you've just used, sort of feeling at home in a place, that really comes through as that was the effort of what at least white settler scientists and capitalists were doing in these different sites, as opposed to the other many ways, often indigenous ways, that the places were narrated as well. And so throughout the book, one of the recurring stories that's told is that the reason why these remarkable landscape features are where they are and why they look the way they are, because they're truly tremendous and either beautiful and or amazing feats of engineering, is that they were built, created, discovered by the Lost White Tribe. And so this comes through all of the stories. Like there is some thread of this narrative in which explanations that could be based in Native and Indigenous history and would also require acknowledging the that dispossession, actually by white settler scientists, or simply you know, land surveyors or other sorts of capitalists, that the origins were actually with white people. So could you just talk, like, tell listeners that story of that's recurring of the Lost White Tribe?
Yeah, it's definitely a recurring theme. And it's one of those things that's so ubiquitous in 19th and 20th century, like sort of US popular culture and like antiquarian thought, that like, it's not shocking that it shows up in all of these places, but it is like something to really think about. You know, it's like a real, the persistence of that desire is telling us something. And to me, it really does represent a desire to like parse the landscape in such a way as to like justify colonization and again like provide this sense of belonging for people who you know, at the time, you know, in the early 19th century, who are participating in Indigenous dispossession and have seen what that actually looks like and are reading the newspaper headlines every day. And so like in that context where like you can read a newspaper headline about, you know, wars against the Dakota, and also read a newspaper story about like evidence of the lost white race discovered in a mound, like that is clearly trying to resolve a contradiction for people.
Yeah. And so thinking about that in terms of the first section on the mounds, I wonder if you could give us a visual. Is there a way you could sort of describe what these mounds look like so we can chat them about them a bit?
Yeah. Well, I guess this book will also be probably featured on the New Books Network soon, but Chadwick Allen has a new book out called Earthworks Rising. And so his work was really important in I'm sort of doing a history of, you know, settler perspectives on these sites and the, like, you know, political analysis of that. And Allen is looking at like what these sites mean for Indigenous communities and continue to mean. And so I think that element was really important for me just situating what I'm doing appropriately. And so these are, you know, throughout the Mississippi and Ohio River valleys, there are dating from different periods, these sort of monumental earthworks. Some of them are burial mounds that are like conical. The Grave Creek Mound in present day West Virginia is, I think, like 63 feet tall. So and the Cahokia, which is a ceremonial mound, is even larger. And so they have all of these different functions. Again, you know, burial ceremonies, public gatherings, and then there are effigy mounds that are shaped like animals, figures. And so for people who were traveling west down the Ohio River in the early part of the 19th century, these were kind of like big tourist spots, because there was this feeling people often bemoaned that North America had no castles, it had no cathedrals, it had none of these evidences of great civilization that these European settlers were familiar with in their history books. And so they looked at the mounds and wanted to understand them in that context of civilization and civilizational narratives that they were familiar with. Which include these narratives of kind of like conquest and collapse. And so they came to read them as they assumed that anything attaining the status of like a monument couldn't have been built by Indigenous people because of their race science and their attitudes. And so then they sort of attribute this to another race predating Indians and come up with stories about who those people were and attribute to them all of the sort of virtues of civilization and then depict themselves, Europeans, as continuing or reclaiming even the legacy of the people who built those monuments.
Yeah, so the book, especially in that section, but throughout the book, you're looking at efforts to pin down the origin, and really locating that effort as a capitalist effort to basically kind of atomize and bound something like an event, and to have it be single. Have it be just one source and one story. And so one of the things that this really made me wonder is about your relationship with historical truth, because the book certainly does not want to create a new origin story, but instead show how to give a history of how origin stories are created. But then it makes me wonder how you are able to make claims about what is true and not true historically, because this is a question I struggle with myself.
It's definitely a difficult question. And for me, it's, I guess, all about sources. It's about the sort of relationality of historical work, that you're engaging with other people's work and kind of like from within that, like looking at your subject matter and trying to understand what the connections are and like how you want to sort of interpret events with whatever wisdom is available in the work of other scholars that they're offering. Like, I think there are a lot of sources in the book that are kind of like unreliable that I don't necessarily trust, like primary sources. And it does kind of become a matter of like, what are the values with which you're approaching the larger narrative? And how does that shape your interpretation of sources? And I know that this is sort of maybe anathema to the way some people work with sources, but I think for me that is really important, like how I'm making sense of this world is related to my understanding of its politics and what kind of, I think, is a faithful way of representing that. But it's definitely difficult.
I appreciated even so far in our conversation, the way in which you're showing your relationships with other texts. For example, in letting listeners know about Earthwork Rising, for example, and the politics of citation of In Whose Ruins, I also really appreciated, because there are moments in which you very easily could have explained or referred to one set of scholars, and in particular, you then highlight a Native or Indigenous scholar who's working in a similar vein. So I just really appreciated that about the book. And there's a sentence actually in the first section of In Whose Ruins, I feel like that is a comment on one of your historical actors, or it's a description of what one of your historical actors has done. But I feel like it's also a statement about the politics of the book that you've just described. And so you're talking about Schoolcraft, one of the main characters in the first section on the earth mounds. And you write that, you know, after he had produced a text in which he got totally hornswoggled, like he wrote something and it turned out to be completely wrong. And you write, in the habit of molding his evidence to please white readers, rather than communicating the reality of his Indigenous relations, Henry Schoolcraft set himself up to be swindled by a small town hoax. And I feel like that statement about living in good relation, writing in good relation was especially apt. So in continuing to think about the mounds and Schoolcraft kind of emerging out of your first project, Common Phantoms, I wonder if you could tell us about the relationship between Jane, the anglicized name of his first wife, but the relationship between Jane and Schoolcraft, and why that relationship was really evocative for you.
It's been a very compelling relationship, I think, for a lot of historians and poets. And so actually this is a point where I engaged with Jane Johnson Schoolcraft's work because I was interested in her as a poet. And that sort of strand crossed with her husband's work as an ethnologist. And then sort of, you know, subsequent Native American poets have also kind of looked to her as sort of a precursor and been very interested in her life story. And for me, again, like coming at this from sort of a history of archaeology and anthropology perspective, you know, what Henry is doing in kind of trying to give voice to, trying to channel Indigenous stories is, I find sort of the Grave Creek Stone, this archaeological hoax that was uncovered in the Grave Creek Mound, planted there by a resident of the town, but then sort of trumpeted as evidence of the lost white race as having been created by ancient, like, Celts or Phoenicians or anyone. So this fraudulent artifact is something that Henry Schoolcraft, brandishing his non-existent philological skills, is trying to give a voice to and claim and sort of build this narrative of American history and justification around. And looking at his earlier history as an Indian agent in the Michigan Territory, like, you see him doing something very similar with his wife, Jane, and her family and the stories that they collected, which, you know, really they did this in the context of, like, a lot of collective labor. Jane wrote a lot of the stories, translated a lot of the stories. Her brothers are involved. One of her brothers later is angry at Henry for publishing this material and demands a piece of the royalties. And so, yeah, I think that question of, like, who's speaking for whom is illuminated in that crossing of, like, the Grave Creek Stone, this fake thing, and Henry's attempts to sell Ojibwe stories, which were a real thing and are a real thing, but the way that he produced it for as a resource and as something to be consumed by white readers is very much inflected with his politics and his service to the United States.
So that was a story that's showing us something about relationality, in which a rock sort of featured as the hoax. And in section three, we are actually looking at sort of a different rock altogether, but it's really the object that gets moved around and has its context in which it originally turned up for white settlers in the process of creating a dam. And so I love the third section. I love all the sections, but the third section, and especially the first sentence, because it is simply, what were they thinking? And so the section is looking at petroglyphs, and specifically the river in which petroglyphs were situated once it was dammed. So tell us a bit, if you could imagine into the minds of the people and what your question here is about, what were they thinking? What happened and what were they thinking?
Yeah, it's funny because I hadn't actually thought about that question. I hadn't thought about answering that question, but I think in a way the answer is really obvious, and is that they weren't thinking anything, because this was just business. You know, this was just the business that lay before them. And I think Henry Schoolcraft is a similar situation where from our vantage point, we would ask, what was he thinking?
Just to clarify, they detonated. So these entrepreneurs, these capitalists detonated just tons of explosives in a site that they specifically knew had these really interesting and important petroglyphs in them.
Yeah, so this is on the Susquehanna River in Maryland, just below the Pennsylvania line. And it's the Baltimore Academy of Sciences that has gone on this mission to, in their mind, preserve these indigenous petroglyphs which are going to be submerged with the construction of the Conowingo Dam, which was completed, I think, in 1926. And the petroglyphs were removed, I think, the year before. And so, yeah, they're kind of like dynamiting chunks of these huge boulders in the river and collecting the pieces. And then they sort of cement them back together and mount them in front of the Science Academy headquarters. And that, yeah, that kind of is another one of these emblematic moments of like erasing, claiming, and then giving a new story for these artifacts. And I think it's important that the instigation for this, you know, they wouldn't have done this if it were not for the construction of the dam. And in their minds, and I think, you know, an important thing for all historical preservationists to consider is like, what does it mean to preserve and where does that come into contact with destroying? But so they're rescuing in their minds these petroglyphs for science, to be used for scientific purposes to advance knowledge of whoever made these petroglyphs, which might have actually been Europeans, according to some.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So in this section as well, we have the return of the story of the lost white tribe to explain where these could have possibly come from. And as you point out, it also like calls into question or raises the issue of who is the public in thinking about public resources and what is being done in the name of a public who is included in that. And for these in particular, in this section in particular, you actually show up for the first time. We're almost on page 300 here, and you use the word I for the very first time in talking about driving across the dam. And there's a story of you actually experiencing the rocks and the petroglyphs for the first time. And so I wonder if you could actually just describe what they look like and also how possibly this could have been attributed to this lost white tribe.
That's interesting. I didn't know that about the book. I think that, well, there's also something to be said about like writing for a trade press, which is that I think it was sometimes unclear to me, like, I think a lot of these books are written as kind of like travelogues. And there are a lot of like going to a place, here's an interesting historical thing, here's like the myth and here's the reality. And the author is sometimes more present for that sort of thing. And I didn't choose to go in that direction, but I did visit some of these places. And so, yeah, I frequently travel across the Conowingo Dam from Baltimore to Philly. And I went to visit the petroglyphs in their current, well, some of them are in the Maryland State Archaeology like warehouse. And some of them, thanks to the efforts of the Chesapeake Conservatory of the Onondaga Nation, and Sid Jameson in particular, who helped to advocate for this, some of them have been relocated to the banks of the Susquehanna River right under the dam. And so they're kind of in this old mill house that's very like dusty and full of bits of grain floating around. And they're kind of mounted in traditional like historical display style. You know, there's informational text, there's like photographs. And so it's a very humble little exhibit. And I think it would be really interesting to see something more ambitious done in terms of resituating more of those petroglyphs near their original site.
It's such a great point about the comparing the different locations of the petroglyphs. So some of them were recited to the museum context, and some of them, I mean, after they were located in just a pile in a park without any acknowledgement or understanding what these were, they're relocated to a museum situation. But some of them, in reciting them, were put back at the river. And so it's just such a really sort of evocative, and I feel like there's a statement about politics in there, in the choice of what is the site to be done in the 21st century, the right site for them in the 21st century. And you have a sentence that I just found especially beautiful in this section three, which is when you're introducing the petroglyphs, you write, "For a century, these petroglyphs would struggle to express meaning without their context. They told an indigenous history of the land, which to white scientists appeared a mystery." So it's again the idea of a relationship, and a relationship between sort of the rocks, the petroglyphs, and the place in which they're supposed to be located according to the objects themselves. So it's really, really interesting. Regarding you writing about yourself in the first person for the first time around there, which I see now, it was actually just a bit into the 200s of the book. But I took note of it because it's also something that I have a lot of questions about, and I note when I'm reading various authors, because I think that there are different approaches to it. I should say that you use a lot of free direct discourse, which I really, really like. So the idea that you are speaking directly to me, even though you're not using the word I, that is certainly the voice of the book. And I do have the sense that it's common, it's a common approach to indicate one's relationship with a text by speaking in the first person and telling one's own stories. But I feel like often that has the effect of centering the person who's telling the story as opposed to the relationships that they're wanting to center. So I really liked how you did this. And I could imagine that it wouldn't be an obvious choice for somebody, for an editor, for example, who was encouraging you to write in a way that would be something like a travel narrative kind of genre. So also say, I did really appreciate it and like it quite a bit.
That's really good to hear. Yeah, my editor was actually very helpful in that regard. And I was prepared to be asked to do something more travelogue-y because it's a trade publication. And I was happy to not to do that. And the editor was very supportive, like encouraged it. And so I think that was a good experience. I think that aspect of the petroglyphs being sort of mysterious, and that dislocation creating a sense of mystery, is another really important, was another sort of spur to me across all of the areas that are covered in the book. Like, and I teach a class on mystery, on mystery fiction. And so I think about this all the time, but like, how is something, you know, it's that the pivot from mystery to mystification, like, how do the origins of this thing become concealed? This is not accidental, you know, someone does this for a reason. And is often then presented to the public as something that's just entertaining. It's just a mystery. And so I think that that's an aspect of, like, again, of sort of lost race theories that I find very important to analyze and think critically about. And so, yeah, this idea that, like, these petroglyphs don't make any sense and need to be deciphered is kind of a product of their dislocation. And the way that they circulate is an interesting aspect of the story that I, again, kind of crosses the circulation of power on the electric grid. And so the construction of the dam as a way of turning the river into a resource that then flows and is liquid sort of crosses this attempt to do that with the petroglyphs that doesn't work that well because they're very heavy.
Yeah, and the subtitle of the book is Power, Possession, and the Landscapes of American Empire. And I had assumed that power meant political power when I first started reading the book, but actually it's quite clear through each of the sections, because you've got oil wells, you've got this hydropower dam, you've got Los Alamos and nuclear energy, that it's also, you know, electrical power. It's other forms of power beyond that as well that are not the political power that I had originally thought that the power referred to. So it's a both and story. And your comment about mystery, and I love that you teach a course on mystery. Did you say it's mystery fiction? What was the course?
Yeah, I call it medical mysteries. It's like detective fiction and the idea of medical mystery.
Yeah. Okay. The idea of closing off a mystery as something that doesn't need to be acknowledged as having some sort of labor or intention behind it also reminds me of issues around the language of magic. And even enchantment, like sometimes magic can be a way to close something down as opposed to acknowledging and recognizing the labor behind it. And it was actually an interview with the artist formerly known as Prince and formerly alive, now deceased, in which he actually got really, they got really upset when people would say that their music was like magic. And he was like, no, it's actually like a lot of work and this is how I do it. So the idea of magic often operating for that function is really resonant in thinking about your comment regarding mysteries.
Wow, I love that. I love that he would say that.
I do too. So in moving from the petroglyphs and thinking about a really violent action, the big explosion that was intended to be an effort at preservation among the white community. We then move in section four to Los Alamos in US New Mexico. And I wonder if you could talk about what got you there. So the previous three sections are in basically the US mid-Atlantic kind of region, so West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland area, and then we have Los Alamos. So what brought you there?
There's kind of a future-oriented, there's a future element and a past element. Like I was thinking about sources of power that have, well, thinking about nuclear fuel as something that is somewhat unique at the time, was unique in its implications for futurity, that this source of power was essential, was promoted as absolutely essential to securing US hegemony, but also threatened the global future in a way that people had never seen before, completely apocalyptic destruction. And so I think that the need, the imperative to seize this resource and fulfill what people, you know, spoke of as kind of its destiny, again, in this kind of teleological thinking about resources, that it was clearly put there to fulfill this purpose. Yet also in doing so, we threaten even the possibility of a future. That kind of intrigued me as the kind of resource that I would want to conclude the book with. And of course, it's very resonant now with issues of climate change. And in looking back on anti-nuclear activism, it just sounded very familiar and fresh, and like exactly the kind of conversations that we're having today. So that's sort of the future element of it. Like, I wanted something that would turn from the past and look at the future implications of resource use. But at the same time, and if, like, inevitably intertwined with that, is the way that people then and there were looking to the past as a justification and a source of meaning for their work. And so there's actually a line, there's a scene in this Willa Cather novel, Song of the Lark, where the protagonist is resting, is taking the rest cure in at like a ranch in New Mexico, and is walking through a Pueblo and ancestral site that has all of these, that has, you know, broken pottery all over, and has this sort of ecstatic communion with the past. And Cather describes her as sort of connecting with this vital flow of creative power from the indigenous people who were there. And then she's an opera singer. And so then she, like, this transforms her voice, and she becomes this unique American voice on the stage. And that really just, like, captured everything about that move, which, you know, artists and writers were looking to the Southwest at that time as a source of creative vitality. And it becomes a tourist destination, and people are collecting pottery and rugs and all of these indigenous craft objects. And the people who come to Los Alamos are engaged in that same economy.
It's so fascinating to read, and thinking about the different genres that you're pulling from, in addition to this really tremendous story within a story of Willa Cather. And it's the Song of the Lark. Am I getting the name of it right? Yeah. Section four on Los Alamos and nuclear fuel was probably the first time I've ever seen the cartoon Crazy Cat and Thomas Kuhn brought together in one place. So I really just need to ask you about your passion for Crazy Cat and what you feel like Crazy Cat can tell us.
I think it's just a really great comic, and everyone should read it. And when I was revisiting it, not related to this project, but I started noting, like, I always knew that it was in a desert, but I started looking at the pottery that's in all of the strips and in the, like, landscape formations. And I was like, oh, I need to look into this, because George Harriman, was basing it on New Mexico, on his extended visits to New Mexico. And I wanted to frame the section through the, like, lens of Harriman and Crazy Cat, in part because, like, a lot of the book is concerned with appropriation and these, and violence, and this sort of the way that even art and, you know, spirituality can become wrapped up in these processes of domination and consumption. And so I felt like Harriman's way of engaging with the landscapes of the Southwest represented something more hopeful, not something perfect, but something that, like, you know, he had that same desire. He found that same spiritual sustenance in that place. But he's doing something with it that isn't just recapitulating this sense of ownership and, it, you know, sort of manifest destiny, and isn't quite making it into a resource. It's more of, you know, it's more of a dreamed space, and it's kind of a way of like redreaming what might be possible in these spaces.
Yeah, I really love that reading and use of art that itself is imperfect and has little inflections of potential appropriation and also violence in Crazy Cat. But the way that you're reading it, or in addition, the way that you're reading it as having and accomplishing a sort of non-extractive practice and having a non-extractive value as well, or a value outside of capitalism, or not determined strictly by it. Each of the sections in the book overall is like the stories of the lost white tribe as a way of kind of understanding in this very dominant, white dominant sort of fashion, what the origins of a place or an object are. Another through line is, as you're suggesting, the idea of manifest destiny, and that white settlers are the rightful owners and possessors and users of land and land formations. And so it seems like what you're trying to get at in thinking about manifest destiny through each of the four sections and its problems and its future, the future of this idea, is the idea of inevitable growth and progress, which is both a political and an economic statement. And along with that, the constant fear of decline and collapse as well. And so that's why the idea of something being sort of quote unquote discovered, or having like an additional seeming event of discovery that suggests that something came before, is very unsettling for folks who are thinking through and really admiring a story of manifest destiny, of onward marches and greater growth and greater progress, because it means that they also might have some vulnerabilities there. And so I really admire and like the sort of future turning and encouraging readers to redream the present and dream the future together. And so as we start to wrap up, I just wanted to ask you whether this work and this project has changed your own everyday practices around capitalism, or have you kind of admired seeing the little anti-capitalist practices that other people have done? So do you feel like this book or the project has changed you in any way and your practices?
It was definitely an education for me in Indigenous history, which I was never taught. And I feel a lot of insecurities about my ability to engage with that literature, but I felt like it was very important to put in as much as possible, and again, like, cite as much as possible. And so that was kind of the part of my education that was most lacking. But something that I was always aware, what made me seek out that literature was moving through landscapes and knowing, knowing that there was something wrong. Yeah, it's like we know how this came to be, but not exactly. And like, it needs, it needs to be treated in much greater detail. And so I think that like resolved, like, and any, like, it did, well, it didn't resolve, but like it helped me understand like why I was having that experience every, you know, whenever traveling anywhere in this place. And in terms of like my relationship to capitalism, I think is a expression of just where, like, I've been a socialist since I can remember, and it has always been an important part of my life. And having to like try to sell a book is even very like weird and difficult for me, but I do need to pay my bills. But yeah, I think that it is the most direct expression of like kind of my values that I've been able to incorporate into my work.
I really appreciate it. I know that others will too. So just to wrap up, I do want to just read some of the final sentences of the book, because the writing is really beautiful. It's funny and it's descriptive, and it also treats in a way that can feel comfortable getting close to events and people and relationships that are also really violent and extractive as well. But you write at the very end of the book that myths of extinction push outside their frame the even more disturbing possibility, that the mutations of the country could turn people's minds to justice and that they could seek it with each other. So many of our stories dance around the horror of a treasure that's cursed and fear of letting it go. The point is to see that not as ruin, but as life itself. So thanks so much, Alicia.
Thank you so much for this conversation.